It's now time for the Fantasy 411 Podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411 Podcast. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with Fred Zinke. Spring training is getting closer every day. When we record this next week, we will be able to say that next week it's spring training. Somewhat unusually, I think, for this time of year, we actually have quite a bit of stuff to talk about. So, Fred, how you doing? You ready to talk some fantasy baseball?
Yeah, for sure. As you said, it felt good to pin the calendar to February. That means we're getting really close to some real baseball.
Yeah, that's how you know you're in baseball, is when February excites you. We had a fascinating trade. We'll start with a trade that was really interesting from – actually, both our trades this week were interesting from both the fantasy and the actual baseball perspective. The Rays and Rockies made a move in which the marquee name – was Corey Dickerson, and the obvious question is obvious. It's kind of a dent to Corey Dickerson's value to move from Planet Coors to Tropicana, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And he moves to a team that has the potential to platoon him. He's not great, hasn't been great against left-handers. With the Rockies, I guess before they signed Parra, it seemed like he was going to get a chance maybe to work that out and stay in the lineup every day. Now the Rays look like they've built a roster that can be very platoon heavy, and so he could lose both volume and effectiveness across the volume that he does have.
How broadly, let me rephrase that. Broadly, how do you rate him now? I mean, in a relatively, it's clear there's a ding to his value, but he's a guy who's got some real skill. He's a guy that people love, his bat speed. He's an exciting player. How do you value Corey Dickerson now that he is a member of the Rays?
Yeah, I used to feel, coming off that injury plague season, that Dickerson was a nice value maybe in like round 5 or 6, and then you hope that you get maybe round 3 type protection out of him when he was a member of the Rockies. Now I feel like he's a nice value maybe closer to round 10, and then you hope that you get, you know, round 6 or 7 production. So I'm not feeling awesome about taking him, say in a 12 team league. I'm not feeling awesome about taking him in the first 7 or 8 rounds, but then I would start to be interested.
But I guess, and kind of what you're getting at here, is there is upside there. I mean, this is not – fair to say that among the various sort of corner pieces that the Rays have, and they've got a ton of them, which is part of what complicates all of this, do you agree that he's probably the guy with the most chance to emerge as a really exciting, valuable player this year?
Yes, I think so, for sure. I mean, they just paid a fairly heavy price for him. They gave up one of their best relief pitchers, maybe their best relief pitcher. So you would assume that they're going to really promote him and try to, you know, get him to show that he's better than what he was on the road. That's the other concern. You know, when he was a member of the Rockies on the road, he wasn't that strong, and that's raised a lot of concerns. I think the Rays are going to, well, show that they believe that he's better than that player of what he did when he wasn't at Coors Field.
And I kind of want to delve into that a little bit, because we had a piece on MLB.com that I thought was very interesting. Actually, originally ran, I think, a month or two ago, and was talking about Carlos Gonzalez at the time. But Mike Petriello, who does some really interesting stuff, had a piece that basically said we should really be careful about that stuff. That, yes, Coors is a great place to hit, but that if you just take a guy's road numbers, that's also misleading. Because in a lot of there seems to be some kind of Coors effect on the road, that it bumps up your numbers at home, but also hurts guys on the road for some reason. How do you kind of adjust when you're looking? Now, again, we're also accounting for Tampa Bay not being just any old ballpark, but how do you sort of account, if you can't just quick look at the road numbers, how do you kind of make that mental adjustment for a guy leaving Denver?
Yeah, you're going to have to, and we've seen with, you know, players like Matt Holliday, we've seen guys leave Colorado and still have really productive offensive seasons with their new teams. So it's not like you can just paint everyone with the same brush. So, you know, this is the time maybe you go back to scouting reports, some anecdotal stuff. You can't just take, say, their OPS and their career on the road and say that's what's going to happen. And you're right, this trade has really sparked some really interesting discussions at a lot of sites about, you know, how hitters with the Rockies are challenged based on the different parks that they visit compared to when they're at home. So, I mean, you can't really paint them all with the same brush. You just have to try to analyze them and listen to what our scouts are saying and see how you think they can adjust.
That's one of about 3 or 4 facets of this trade. And the next one is that Rockies outfield? The guys who are left, and we talked about this, I think, in the first one of these that I did with you, there was a real question as to who was going to stay. It now seems likely that everybody who is there is still going to stay, though there was some talk of a move even before they signed Parra. But does this kind of give a little bump to the guys who stay, and is there anybody in that group of outfielders that you particularly like? I mean, excepting Carlos Gonzalez, who is sort of universally known as a stud. Is there another of that guys in that mix that you particularly like?
Well, I like Blackman, you know. For fantasy, I like Blackman a lot more than Gonzalez just because of all the bases he can steal. But the big bump from this, you know, comes to Parra and the fact that Parra is now an everyday player. And, you know, we've discussed him on previous episodes of the podcast, but he's always played in hitter-friendly parks, but not one this hitter-friendly. He now, to me, is that they got rid of Dickerson, is back on mixed league draft list. He should go in every league this year. He's going to be someone who's really effective, you know, if you can stream him, especially in a shallow league where you could have some outfielders on your bench. If you can use him the weeks he's at home and sit him maybe the weeks he's on the road, I think like Blackman and Gonzalez are beyond that. You're going to play them either way and just know that you'll get better production from them when they're at home. But Parra probably shuffles in and out of your lineup.
Then there's one other piece to this that I think is really interesting, and to sort of get into some of this. I'm fascinated by park factors. I'm fascinated by Denver. They bring in Jake McGee. They also signed Jason Mott this year. And there's some theory that maybe what's going on here is that the current idea, and there's an idea about every 2 weeks about Denver, but that the current idea is the more fastballs you throw, the more immune you are to Denver. And it kind of academically makes some sense. You just kind of look at it at face value. Yeah, if you're not expecting your breaking ball to break, you just throw a fastball and locate it, you're going to be good. Mott and McGee are two guys near the very top in fastball percentage. Do you maybe ding those guys a little less knowing that there's some theory behind what they're doing here?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, you know, we don't often see productive mixed league closers come from the Rockies team. But Houston Street showed us, you know, for a time that it's possible, and he's not the only one. So, you know, it comes down to, is McGee going to be the closer, or is Mott going to be the closer? People seem to be leaning McGee. And then, you know, can he deliver you at least solid ratios while pitching in that environment? And I guess it also comes down to, can they give him the close leads to protect? We've talked previously about different teams and, you know, how some bad teams do win a lot of close games because they don't score a lot of runs. And the Rockies don't really fit that mold where you can picture them next season not winning a lot of games. And when they do win games, sometimes winning those shootouts at Coors that maybe don't end up, you know, within three runs. So it's I'm interested in McGee. I wouldn't be really interested in Mott. When I thought Mott was going to be the closer, I wasn't really interested in him. But I am pretty interested in McGee, especially if they, you know, officially say he is the closer.
Do you adjust that at all with the possibility that Ottavino could still be on the horizon at some point, or are you just not worried about that?
I think McGee's such a good pitcher that if he's not really adversely affected by Coors, that, you know, that he could be a really solid closer for them. And then I know Ottavino's coming back, but he's coming back in the middle of the year off Tommy John. It just, to me, doesn't really make sense for them long-term to make him the closer right away because closers have erratic schedules. I would think if I had a young pitcher coming back from Tommy John and I already had a pitcher like Jake McGee working the ninth inning, even if I thought Ottavino was a long-term closer for our team, when he first comes back, I would say, you know, you're going to work in a middle relief role, and we're going to make sure you pitch at the frequency that we want you to pitch, and we'll let McGee go sometimes 4 days between appearances and then appear 3 days in a row or something like that. I don't feel like he's a threat this year. And then with the Rockies, who knows where we'll be at a year from now.
Sure, sure. And then that was only one of two very curious trades this week, and the other was probably even curiouser. And that was between the Diamondbacks and Brewers. Gene Segura and Chase Anderson being the kind of two key pieces in this, and I still haven't entirely wrapped my head around this, but Segura's a guy, it sounds like if nothing else, he's going to hit at the top of the order. He's going from one good place to hit to another, coming off a down year. Does a combination of position and speed do enough for Segura that he's a guy you like at least some going into drafts?
Yeah, like we're moving from one sometimes confusing team with the Rockies to another. Maybe the most confusing team I find the last few months is the Diamondbacks. I was surprised that they really wanted Segura because he hasn't done a great job getting on base the past couple seasons. And then even more surprised that they're going to put him in a prominent lineup spot. We don't really know where he's going to play. Like I saw kind of comments from Dave Stewart saying he was going to mostly play shortstop in spring training, but he might be their second baseman. So it's really unclear where they're going, but let's assume that they traded for him for the purpose of having him in their regular lineup. If he hits either in between Pollock and Goldschmidt or right in front of Pollock and Goldschmidt, now he's got a lot of potential between the base stealing and then getting involved in run production. And when I look through that lineup, I guess I don't see a lot of other great options to hit either first or second. Pollock can have one of those spots. You know, who else, when you look around there, really fits the profile to hit at the top of the lineup? Segura doesn't to me, but neither does anyone else.
Right, he's very much one of those guys who is a great example of the difference between somebody who helps an actual offense and somebody who helps a fantasy team, because I'm not at all convinced Segura is in any way a guy I'd want hitting in my lineup. But my fantasy team, I can see that, you know, 260 or whatever he hits with a 290 on base, you're not really caring that much about the on base. I think the one question I would have is, you mentioned, you know, say he's hitting in front of Pollock and Goldschmidt, do they maybe run him a little less, and maybe you trade that for some runs scored, because he certainly will be hitting in front of more dangerous guys than he was in Milwaukee, but do you worry any about him maybe running a little less if he's hitting in front of Paul Goldschmidt?
Maybe a little bit if he hits second in front of Goldschmidt. If he were to hit leadoff in front of Pollock, then maybe I don't, because I don't think Pollock's a really good hitter, but he's maybe not someone who you hold, because he's not as much of a home run hitter, someone who you don't worry as much about sending a runner, because, you know, he makes good contact, or you get a runner over to second, then Pollock can score them on a single. So I don't worry about that quite as much. The other thing is the Diamondbacks lineup drops off fairly quickly after Goldschmidt. Like, Peralta's next. He's good against right-handers, and that's about it. And then after that, it's not such a strong lineup. So, you know, let's say Segura's hitting second and he's on first and Goldschmidt's up. Well, if Goldschmidt doesn't reach base, you know, he's still on first when Peralta's up or whoever's hitting cleanup if they're facing a lefty. So I wouldn't be too concerned. I'd be pretty excited about him if he's hitting up near the top lineup, and then I just cross my fingers on the steals. If he hits lower in the lineup because of the poor on-base skills, then I don't think he's really a mixed league player anymore.
And then the other main part of this trade is Chase Anderson, who to me is basically just a guy, but he's just a guy who presumably is going to have a very safe rotation spot and is going, I don't know, I mean, it depends on what you look, park factors aren't all that consistent, but I think I would rather have a pitcher in Milwaukee than a pitcher in Phoenix, I guess. Is he more than just a guy for you? Is he somebody who catches your eye, or is he just kind of filler, somebody you maybe stream with a good matchup?
Yeah, I think for now he's just a guy for me. We have seen, like, phases with him where he'll, you know, have a good month here and there. It's just, it doesn't really seem to be lined up for him to have a breakout season. You know, Milwaukee, as you said, is, like, the best place to pitch. They don't look like they're going to have the best bullpen this year or be one of the best teams, and they're in a really hard division. I think Chase Anderson's kind of a guy in the sense of, had he been traded to the San Francisco Giants, the St. Louis Cardinals, and was put into their rotation, then we would be interested in him. But he probably needs a favorable situation, or he needs to show us a big jump in skill in some way before mixed league owners would be interested.
Yeah, you raise an interesting point there, and I don't want to get too far into this. And we don't really talk that much. We used to talk about guys going to the AL East, and particular pitchers going to the AL East, and what a gauntlet that was. I'm not sure that's such a thing anymore, except with the one you note, which is guys going to Cincinnati and Milwaukee, or who are in Cincinnati and Milwaukee, that's an awfully tough slate. Those are three of the best teams in either league, and they're good on both sides of the ball. Do you think when you see guys in Milwaukee and Cincinnati in particular, where they have to see those three teams 50-plus times a year, is that a little bit of a nick on their value as you put together lists and values and whatnot?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's not so much a nick for their ratios, like you talked about that AL East, you know, theory. Like St. Louis and Pittsburgh, for example, I think will be really good teams. I don't know if they're going to be among the highest scoring teams in the league where you're scared to put someone against them, but it's the win potential. Like when you use the starting pitcher, you have to have, especially in a mixed league, you have to have some confidence they have a chance to come away with a win. And so you take, if you look at the pitchers in those two rotations, there aren't any standouts. So, and then the pitchers they'll be going against on those teams are usually quite good, and then they don't have the bullpen support or the lineup support. It just seems like the deck's so stacked so heavily against them in a lot of their starts that I just don't see the point in drafting him, because I feel like so many weeks you'll just look at the matchup and think, I just don't want to use him this week. What can I get off waivers? And if that's the direction you're going to go, then don't take someone.
And then the last name that people know in this deal, Aaron Hill, coming off a terrible year, but you know, a year ago he drove in 60 runs. Excuse me, yeah, a year ago, 14. In 13 he hit 290. In 12 he was a stud. Is he in any way an end-of-a-draft flyer for you, or is he a guy who just doesn't hold any interest at all?
Yeah, he's one of the more erratic fantasy assets we've seen in the last few years, but I think his peaks are gone. To me, I'm not interested in him. I would be a little interested in Jonathan Villar, because it looks like he's going to be the shortstop at the start of the season, and I know they have Arcia on the way. But you could get some cheap steals out of Villar, especially if you just don't like what happens in your draft at shortstop and you're just thinking at the end, you know, maybe I can find someone who can get me through the first month or two and then I'll figure it out from there. He's kind of, I'm interested in him just for that one reason. With Hill, maybe he'll be their third baseman all season, but I just don't see stats that a mixed league owner would want. And I'll only, you'd take him for sure because he's going to have regular playing time and we'll see if he keeps it, but not in a mixed league.
Our next transaction worth addressing this week is I think a little bit of a surprise. Howie Kendrick back to the Dodgers. I didn't really see this coming. I don't think the Dodgers saw this coming either when they signed Chase Utley. I mean, Kendrick is himself. He kind of is what he is. But what does it mean to the other guys in that mix? I mean, is Utley off your board in a mixed league? And I guess, was he on it in the first place? We talked about Micah Johnson. It certainly seems to hurt his value. How do you look at this kind of the other guys we'll start with before we talk about Kendrick?
Yeah, I think, yeah, if Utley wasn't already off your board in a mixed league, and he probably should have been, you know, he's off completely now. You can draft him in an NL-only league and hope for a few home runs, and maybe he'll pick up multiple position eligibility because it looks like he might do some filling in at third base. But, yeah, and Micah Johnson now I wouldn't even draft in an NL-only league. You know, Enrique Hernandez, like, he's not going to factor into second base now. It'll be outfield only probably for him. So now he's out for mixed leagues, and I guess you could use him a little bit in an NL-only league. But, yeah, this Kendrick thing kind of squashes any hope for kind of finding sleepers out of that group of players because Kendrick's not going to be exciting, but he's reliable.
And here's the thing about Kendrick that I want to pursue. He's been very, as you know, just very reliable, very consistent. But there's this theory that it's kind of been semi-debunked but not completely debunked, but I kind of can't shake it. This idea that second basemen kind of fall off a cliff, that when second basemen go, they really go, that it's not pretty. Do you have it in the back of your head at all as Kendrick gets into his 30s and after he ran a little less last year? Do you worry about him at all as a decline risk, or can you just not worry about that if you've got a second baseman that you're confident is going to produce?
I think I'm not worried because the investment you're going to make in Kendrick is so low. Like, he's going to go, you know, he's going to be one in a 12-team mixed league, for example. He's going to be one of the last few starters for your lineup. So you're not going to invest a lot in him. If he goes, like if we see him hitting 235 in April, you can probably replace him from waivers. And it's a little disappointing, but it doesn't really ruin your team. Like, I'd be more concerned at the second base position, maybe about someone like Ian Kinsler going in his 30s off a sharp cliff, because you're going to have to invest a pick in the first 10 rounds on him. And so that'll cause more of a dent into what you were anticipating. I actually thought that Kendrick signing was a kind of a smart one for the Dodgers, in the sense of they have a lot of really volatile players in their lineup that could be really good or really bad. You know, this year, Puig, Peterson, Ethier tends to go up and down. And here's a player now who's just hopefully really consistent for them, so it gives them a little bit of stability.
It's interesting that you have even a healthy Kendrick not rated that highly. And the only reason I ask this is that it seems to me that a guy, again, putting aside the decline risk, five straight years he's hit 285 to 295, and he plays regularly with the exception of last year. I realize that's not superstar, but I got to think for some people, batting average in bulk is a nice thing to be able to get, especially for a guy who will get the occasional home run, the occasional RBI. It won't kill you in everything else.
Yeah, it's just the lack. It's like you said, with occasional. Like, I don't feel like we can really predict him. Like, if he's going to reach double digits in homers or steals, that'll, like, it'll probably be in September that he gets to that point. Like, we're thinking probably as a high point, 12, and maybe more realistic, 9 or 10 homers and 9 or 10 steals. And there's enough depth at second base this season that you can either get, you know, players in the earlier rounds that can be in the 15 to 20 range in those categories, or if you want to, it becomes down, kind of comes down to this, like, if you want to wait till later in your draft, do you want to take Kendrick and get the 290 average, but kind of blah production elsewhere? Do you want to try, say, Jonathan Scope, who we talked about a few weeks ago, a really nice sleeper that could get you 20-plus home runs? You know, would you rather go with him and try to make a splash late in your league? I kind of just feel like that's where Kendrick is. If late in your draft you want a little batting average help and you want some consistency, he's your guy. And if you want to make a splash, then he's not your guy. But there's you know, a good dozen or so second basemen, maybe 15, that you think you'll get more counting stats from.
That's fair. Kids, play shortstop. A couple of the topics we want to hit on before we get into some more general stuff. Sandy Alderson suggested that the Mets might use a six-man rotation at times this year. I'm a little skeptical of them actually committing to that, and I didn't really think that was even what he said. But what does that do to your assessments of guys like Harvey, Syndergaard, DeGrom?
Yeah, I decided I'm not going to get too carried away with that comment. I felt like he was more saying he'd throw in a sixth starter on occasions, like if they go a long stretch without a day off or something. What it just sent to me as a big message, and this makes sense after they went so deep into October last season, is, you know, they're going to try to not burn out. I don't think we're going to see a monster innings total out of either Harvey or DeGrom. Not that I was necessarily expecting one, but this is where you hit that tough decision. So Harvey and DeGrom are not in the first five, six starting pitchers off the board. But then after that, they start to become part of the discussion. And if you're going to compare them to, say, someone like Corey Kluber, is that enough to make you say, well, I might get one or two fewer starts from Harvey and DeGrom, I'd rather go with the real workhorse in Kluber? Do you feel like that would maybe tip the scales a little bit and make you go for Kluber, or do you just not care and you'll just take the one that you feel the best about?
I think it's worth asking. I'm a big, big Harvey fan, and it's partly just kind of visceral. He reminds me so much of Clemens, if he were close with somebody else, I love his stuff. I love his approach. I just like the pitcher so much that sort of my personal, not like personal fondness, but he's kind of one of my guys. If it's close, I kind of lean towards him. The question I would ask you is, as we kind of pencil in innings, and I realize that's to some extent a wild guess, where do you pencil those guys in? Do you pencil them in at 180, 190, 200, 210? I mean, I think it's clear they're not going to get to 220, 230, but where do you kind of back of a napkin put those guys for innings as you're doing your assessments?
Yeah, I was kind of, before I heard that comment, I was thinking maybe about 200 even for Harvey and maybe 205 or something for DeGrom, and then I just maybe back off about five innings. So that was kind of my thought, was maybe Harvey gets close to 200 but doesn't quite get there, and maybe DeGrom, like, hits 200 but doesn't exceed it by a lot. And then Syndergaard's a big part of that equation too. Maybe he ends up in the 180s rather than the 190s, something like that. So it's not a big change. Like I said, it just might be a tiebreaker if there are two pitchers that you feel about the same. Because those guys are going in such rare territory where they're both among the top 10 or 11 pitchers off the board.
And one other bit of news this week, Greg Bird is going to be out for the year. You know, I don't think anybody was necessarily counting on Greg Bird, but the Yankees were counting on Greg Bird to give Mark Teixeira the occasional break, and maybe by extension to give Alex Rodriguez the occasional break, to just kind of be a guy that keeps them from running those guys into the ground. Is it a fair question to ask that maybe removing the guy who is going to take some playing time away from Teixeira might hurt Teixeira's value, just in that seems to me that you're a little more worried about a breakdown now if he's got to go a little more often than maybe they were hoping to?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, maybe they'll just use Dustin Ackley at first base a little more. I don't think that's something they want to do. Like, they wanted to use Greg Bird, as you said, but that might be what they have to do to pace Teixeira. But, you know, it does spark maybe some interest in Aaron Judge. Now he's maybe one step closer to giving them, if they need an impact bat at some point, he could get called up. And maybe it helps Aaron Hicks a little bit and allows him, maybe he's like maybe a little bit closer now to having moving from that fourth outfielder role to a starting role, because I think we all look at that Yankees roster and see a lot of injury potential with all those veterans.
Yeah, and one thing I would wonder about, just sort of going with this, is there's still not really that right-handed complement to Teixeira. And I feel like as much as anything to worry about Teixeira right now is guy's just not a threat against lefties. And there's still not that guy to really shield him there until and unless Aaron Judge gets there. You know what? We'll just table this a little bit because we'll be talking about first baseman in a minute. We'll go into more on Teixeira then. I think he's a really interesting guy. But one thing before we get to that, you had a piece on closer situations, on sort of messy closer situations on MLB.com this week. I certainly encourage people to go find it. And a couple of these situations we talked about last week, when we talked, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, I'm not sure. But one of the ones that really jumped out that you addressed is the Brewers. Francisco Rodriguez gone. You know, Jeremy Jeffress is a guy to watch. I mean, that's a guy with an enormous arm, a guy with a long story, a long struggle to get to where he is. Seems like an awfully high upside guy if it comes together and if he gets the opportunity. What's your kind of sizing up of Jeffress coming into this year?
Yeah, it's just the thought that, you know, the Brewers aren't going to be competing for the postseason. So, and he had a pretty solid year in 2015. So, and like you said, he has that so much potential that maybe they just let him go for it this year. If he looks solid in March, they say, hey, this is the highest upside arm in our bullpen. Let's use this season to find out if he can be the closer. And if they go that route, he's someone with, you know, the potential to give fantasy owners the strikeout rate along with the saves. You know, he's not going to be in those top couple tiers of closers because the Brewers probably won't give him enough save chances and because his whip is probably going to be a little high. But he's usable in a mixed league if he wins that job. And just as the winter's gone on, at first I was kind of feeling like it would be Will Smith. I feel like he has a little more experience. But the more I look at it, you know, with him being left-handed, and he hasn't been that great the last few years, I could see them going with someone with a little more potential like Jeffress.
And then another club that I was intrigued by, that I think people who maybe haven't watched that closely, I think people might think the Marlins situation is settled. But you noted, and our Joe Fusaro has written this as well, that it's actually not settled, that A.J. Ramos is not necessarily clearly the guy. And the guy knocking on his door, Carter Capps, if he were to win that job, would instantly rocket way up the list. How do you assess Capps? Do you just kind of wait and see if something happens in spring training? Do you grab him anyway because the strikeouts are going to be valuable? How do you kind of do the math there?
Yeah, Capps reminds me a little bit of Ken Giles in the sense of, from a fantasy perspective, in the sense of, you know, at this time last year, everyone was talking about how great of a pitcher Ken Giles was and just waiting for the chance for him to be a closer. Little different circumstances, but some similarities to me where everyone, the consensus is that Capps could do the job. He's just got to get the job. And now they seem to have opened the door for him to get it. Now, that being said, Ramos is no slouch. Like, he could hold the job himself through spring training. I wouldn't mind using, in a mixed league, like that last round pick on Capps. And if they come out of spring training and they say, you know what, Ramos is the guy, Capps is heading, you know, to a setup role again. Then if it's a shallow league, you can always just drop him and you can probably still pick up the guy you were going to take anyways. I wouldn't invest a lot in him yet, but there's that potential, as you mentioned, that if he was the closer, he might not be in the top tier of fantasy closers, but he'd probably be in tier two already, which is pretty impressive for someone who hasn't been a closer before.
Yeah, he's a guy that the upside is really enormous. And then one other where there's, it's kind of the opposite really, where the guy who probably is going to get the job, I don't know. Steve Cishek appears to be the guy in Seattle. That will mean saves. That's, you know, even if they're not very good, they're not going to be playing a lot of 12-9 games. But Cishek's a guy I'm awfully skeptical of, even if he has that job. Even if they name him, even if they come and go to opening day and say, Cishek is our guy, how much do you like him?
Yeah, not much. If you're in a shallow mixed league, I think I just wouldn't bother. Like, say, in a 10-team league where, you know, all 30 closers are kind of in play, and I just wouldn't bother. In a 12-team league, to me, I take him in the later rounds. Someone else will probably want him before I do. In a 15-team league, he's going to have value because there just aren't a lot of closers to go around as the league gets deeper. but I'd want to pair him with Joaquin Benoit. And I think in most leagues, what I would rather do is just skip Cishek, let someone else have him, and I'll see if I can get Benoit with a late pick and try to hold him. Like you said, even if he's not the closer on opening day, try to hold him through April and see how Cishek does with those first six or seven save chances.
And now, as promised, let's talk first baseman broadly. Our first base preview is we will do one of these a week. And you've got a one guy all alone in Tier 1, and that's Paul Goldschmidt. To some extent, that's obvious. Is it really the steals that make him alone in Tier 1 ahead of some of the other guys who might be in that conversation?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he gives you the power that you can get from some of the guys we'll talk about in Tier 2, and then he gives you the steals on top of that. It's also the ability to hit for average. You know, when we'll get into Tier 2 in a minute, you'll see some guys who, you know, are more likely to hover in the 260, 270, 280 range, whereas Goldschmidt's been a 300 hitter now, I believe, for three straight seasons. So the fact that you can kind of count on a 300 average, 30-something homers, about 15 to 20 steals, really impressive. I'd love to see that power. Now I'm nitpicking with someone who's going first overall in some fantasy leagues, but I'd just love to see that power go up one more notch. Like, he hasn't had that 40 home run season, and I feel like the potential is there. I don't know if it's still coming off the 2014 injury, but I don't think it's out of the question that we could still see a little more power out of him.
You touched on this a little bit. For you, is he cemented as number three overall, or is there some wiggle room there?
Yeah, for me, he is number three. I would take Harper and Trout ahead of him. To be honest, it's the power. And like I just mentioned, I could see it coming from Goldschmidt, but it hasn't happened. And if I'm picking first overall, I don't want to go on that I can see it coming kind of philosophy. And the fact that Trout and Harper were up over that 40 homer mark last year, I feel like maybe there's, and with Goldschmidt running, you know, not many first basemen maintain that 20 steal type pace for a lot of years. So even though I think we'll get double digit steals from him this season, maybe 15, I just don't see another 20 steal season. So I feel like his stolen base total will come back more similar to Trout's and Harper's. And as I already mentioned earlier in this podcast, I don't love the Diamondbacks lineup, to be honest, outside of him.
Yeah, That's really only the one ding to me, even ahead of the power thing, because I could definitely see it coming. And then you know, your Tier 2 is a really wide mix. And I think it's a really interesting sort of commentary on what first base is, because you've got a variety of different guys. You mentioned batting average. Well, Miguel Cabrera is certainly a guy for that. You've got guys like Rizzo and Abreu, who are sort of all around except speed. You've got Davis, who might hit 220, but also might hit 50 home runs. And you've got Edwin Encarnacion, who, you know, to me is a little bit of a decline risk at his age, but the power is really hard to miss. If I say to you the guy in that group that I think most likely to challenge and make it a more than one guy Tier 1 is Rizzo. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, totally. And he does offer, which the other players in that tier don't, he offers that little bit of speed where he can get double-digit steals. So to me, Rizzo is basically a Goldschmidt clone, just not quite there maybe with the power and the average, but he's pretty much that Goldschmidt clone. And I like, and so do a lot of people, really like that Cubs lineup now. So he could be in a better lineup than Goldschmidt. I could see that if he can just push that batting average up a little bit, push the home run total up a little bit, him, you know, being even with Goldschmidt by the end of the year. I feel like Rizzo's a first rounder in every league.
And that's, to me, the question about Rizzo is he didn't even hit for high average in the minors. He hit 300. He just, when you look at him, looks like a guy who isn't consigned to be a 270, 280 hitter. You watch him hit, and he's got the kind of approach and the kind of stroke that he looks like a guy that it wouldn't shock you if he put up 300, 310. I know we're saying we'd like to see it. Do you think he's got that in them? Do you think he's a guy who could push the average up, say, 20 points?
Yeah, absolutely. I noted in a conversation the other day with a friend that, to me, Rizzo is the perfect blend of safety and upside when you hit the middle of your first round this year. Like, I get those top three guys, and I really like Kershaw. Like, I get those guys are going to go higher. I can see Donaldson going above him. But once you hit kind of picks like 7, 8, 9, 10 this year, I feel like Rizzo is that really nice combination where he's safe. It's hard to see him in that lineup if he's healthy, not having a really good year. And then there's the upside where one of these years, and it could be this one, he takes it to another level, and next year we're talking about him as a top three or four pick. I just really like him for that reason. It's nice to have a first-rounder where you feel safe, but you also can see the potential.
What do you think of Cabrera this year? I mean, the guy hit .338 last year, but he also had 18 home runs, played 119 games. I mean, it's hard not to worry a little about him being on the Albert Pujols decline path, but how do you make sense of Cabrera, who, if he's right, could be a top two or three player overall? I mean, it wouldn't be shocking if Cabrera plays 150 games, hits .330, 35 homers, drives in 110. How do you kind of do that math where you're really worried about the decline, but, boy, the potential is so high?
Yeah, I'm going to be honest. I think I came into this podcast wanting to ask you what you thought of Cabrera, because I think he's kind of boggled my mind in the last few days as much as any player. You're right, you can see both sides. There's that part of me that says we're all going to dismiss him because of age and him having an injury last season, and then by the end of April, he's going to be hitting .340, you know, with six home runs already, and then we're going to just smack ourselves and say, oh my gosh, it was Miguel Cabrera. What was I thinking? Like, why was I doubting this guy? He's probably a future Hall of Famer. Like, why did I do that? And then on the other hand, I can see the possibility for the decline. What encourages me is that he was playing terrific last year. Now his BABIP was really high last year, which was helping boost his batting average. But overall, he was terrific until he was injured. I can't bring myself to label a guy who's been on the disabled list once ever as an injury risk. Like, I just can't get there in my head. I know he's into his, like, getting towards mid-30s, but do you see him as a bigger – okay, how about this? Do you see him as a bigger injury risk than a guy like Giancarlo Stanton, who's much younger but gets hurt all the time?
It's an interesting question. Here's the thing, and you know, we'd like to be rational, and we're never completely rational. And the sort of thing I bring into any conversation of Cabrera, and I touched on this a little bit, is Pujols, and that's because I covered Albert for 10 years, and Albert was one of those guys who just looked indestructible, and he played through everything. My personal theory is that playing through everything is part of why he misses so much time now, but. There are so many parallels between their careers that I can't shake Pujols' decline when I think about Cabrera. The difference to me is that Pujols' batting average started going before the power. Pujols was never a .330 with reduced power guy. He was became a .270 with power guy. So the parallel kind of falls apart there. But that's what I can't shake when I see Cabrera and I see a big guy. I see that body type. And I just worry, again, you make a great point. He's been healthy. He's played a ton. But that's what I can't shake is the idea that this is yet one more way in which his career mirrors Albert Pujols.
Yeah, he's really just so interesting to me this year, because you can't argue with someone who wants to take a mid-first round. Like, you just can't argue with that. He's been so durable. He was hitting about .350 when he got hurt last year. You can't argue with that. But then when I initially started ranking players, I felt like he was more like a late second rounder because of the decline concerns and the injury concerns. Then I start looking at it more, and it's almost like the name takes over a bit, and I start thinking, am I really drafting Edwin Encarnacion ahead of Miguel Cabrera? Like, he's just, like I said, I can see that scenario where at the end of April he's just doing what he always does, and I think, man, I overthought this. And I'll be honest, I have the 14th pick in the labor draft in a couple of weeks, and my mind goes back and forth on if Cabrera's there at pick 14, is he the guy I start my team with? And I can see both sides of it, and it's the one I rack my brain about the most.
He'd be a tough guy for me to pass on there, I think. I don't know that I'm looking to pick him out, but if he's there at that spot, I'd have a hard time saying no on him.
Yeah, and you see, and there's other guys around that point are the upside guys, the Pollocks, the Betts, you know, like Mookie Betts, AJ Pollock, like those, and it's McCutcheon on a bounce back season, so. When you start comparing him to those guys, like I see the upside, I see the downside, and it's hard to know which way I want to go with him. It's a really tough call.
Yeah. As we move down that list, there's another name, another one of those guys that talk about a guy who's tough to pass on at a particular point. You have Votto in tier three. Out of those guys, so it's Votto, Hosmer, Gonzalez, Freeman, Fielder. Votto is easily the guy of that bunch that intrigues me the most because, again, I just wouldn't shock me at all if he put together another one of those, oh my goodness, Joey Votto kinds of years. Is it the lineup as much as anything that sort of knocks him down a step from those tier two guys for you?
Yeah, I think Votto's actually one of the poster boys for being a better real-life player than a fantasy player. Like his second half was ridiculous, but the walk rate was so much a part of it, and that makes him such a valuable real-life player. But in recent seasons, he hasn't produced those massive RBI totals that a lot of those other first basemen in the tiers above him are producing on a regular basis. So, I mean, from Votto, yes, we expect a 300 average, but the home run total, if you're going to set the over-under at 30, I would probably take the under. So I feel like if I'm not getting 30 home runs, and then the RBIs, like we haven't seen him have the 90, 95, 100 RBI seasons recently. So if I'm thinking RBI total in the 80s and less than 30 home runs, it's hard to put him in tier two with the Miguel Cabreras, the Chris Davises, the Encarnacions. That's why he's in tier three for me, but I totally respect what an amazing baseball player he is.
How much does that change if you're in a 5x5 and you're getting 100 runs from him also?
Yeah, it helps for sure, getting the 100 runs, but, you know, like from Chris Davis, I can probably get 90 runs, and then I can probably get 100 to 110 RBIs, whereas from Votto, maybe I get the 100 runs, but I only get about 80 RBIs, so the cumulative totals are lower, and then Davis is going to give me, you know, just trying to compare him to a Tier 2 guy, Davis is going to give me an extra, whatever, 10 or 15 home runs, and he's not going to give me the batting average. So now Votto did steal some bases last year, more than he usually does, and that's a way that he could get into Tier 2. A lot of some of those steals were in the second half, late in the season, so that's another way he could get into Tier 2. But, yeah, it's hard to bank on, you know, him repeating a double-digit steal season.
And you have Duda alone in Tier 4. Man, Duda's a guy I like a lot. I know he's kind of he's all or nothing to some extent, but, you know, he's a guy I wouldn't bank on it. But, boy, if he went Chris Davis on the National League, it wouldn't shock me at all. That guy just hits the ball so hard and so far and has an idea. He's a guy I'd have a hard time passing if all the other guys ahead of him are off the board. Let me put this another way. I probably like Duda more than I like a guy like Hosmer, and maybe even more than a guy like Freeman. I just think the upside is really hard to ignore. Am I just a shameless Duda honk, or could I talk you into ranking him a little higher?
No, I'm a guy who often ends up owning Duda. I feel like in general the fantasy community is not that high on him. What I like about Duda is that I felt like a couple years ago we kind of had him typecast. He's a guy who could hit righties but couldn't really hit lefties. And then he flipped the script on us last year, and he hit lefties really well. And then he was a little worse than he was previously against righties. Well, I'm feeling good about him right now because his success against righties is probably going to come back. So if he can combine the way he faced lefties last year with what he's done in his career against righties, we could see his best season. I do feel like with Duda, though, I don't know, and like I said, I own him a lot, so I kind of follow him closely. There's always stretches of the year where he looks awesome, and then stretches of the year where I feel like he kind of disappears.
Yeah, there aren't many guys who look more lost than Lucas Duda looks when he's lost.
Yeah.
I definitely can't argue that. And then you've got an honorable mention list here. Pujols, Brandon Belt, Ryan Zimmerman, Mark Teixeira. Belt's the most interesting guy to me. I mean, I have no idea what to do with him, which is, I guess, why he's on a others of interest list rather than in one of your tiers. But do you agree with me that he's a guy that you wouldn't be shocked if he had a really nice year?
Yeah, for sure. And I think if we were making this podcast in 2013, we would have said the same thing. And in 2014, we would have said the same thing. In 2015, we would have said the same thing. Like, he has become one of those constant fantasy teases where he plays well enough to keep him on this discussion list of a guy who could be on the verge of a breakout, but then just doesn't really break out. And, you know, usually we see either the guy break out or just go backwards, and, you know, then we just write him off, and he's just not a factor. He always, to me, just hangs on the cusp of being a breakout player. I'm starting to get a little more skeptical that we'll see it, but he's playing well enough that it's still worth drafting him for your corner infield spot and then hope this is the year. Because even if he doesn't have the breakout, he's still decent.
Right, that's the thing. He's not going to hurt you in anything. I mean, I think that batting average 2 years ago was a fluke. He's a good hitter in addition to a guy with power. And, you know, he's still not 28 till April. I mean, that feels like this guy's been around forever, but it's not like he's 2 or 3 years younger than Duda, who I think you kind of think of them as sort of similar age, similar points in their career, but he's still a pretty young guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, the breakout could come. It's just, I think we've hit the point where you can't pay for it. I feel like some people maybe overpaid on Belt a couple of years ago, paying for a large chunk of what the breakout could be at an auction table or in a draft, and they're taking them, you know, up in that, say, up in the tier three. They're taking them with the Hosmers and guys like that a couple of years ago, or the guys who were at that level a couple of years ago, expecting the breakout. I think we can't expect it now, but we can still hope for it, if that makes sense. And that probably makes it, out of all those guys in that persons of interest, he's probably the one I'm most interested in. Maybe Pujols if I have the DL slots, because we saw last season when he's on how powerful he can be.
I mean, and the other thing with Belt is that he could have a baseball breakout and not have a huge fantasy breakout. You know, if Belt put up a 300, 390, 490 kind of year, 20 homers, 40 doubles, 90 RBI, that's a hell of a year, but it's not that great as a fantasy first baseman. And that's the kind of year I could see him having where, yeah, you certainly wouldn't mind having that, but that's still not really going to change your team's season.
Yeah, for sure. And, I mean, he's not helped by his home park. So that also, to me, maybe mutes a little bit of concern where he's not going to get a lot of cheap home runs to spur, like, a big fantasy breakout. Like, if he's going to have the big breakout, he's going to have to earn it. And, you know, when you look at that Giants lineup, and I do think their home park impacts that, you see some great hitters like Posey, like Pence, with good but not great home run totals. It's just might be hard for a guy to luck his way into, you know, 30-plus homers as a member of the Giants.
Sure. All right, well, that's the Fantasy 411 podcast for this week. He's Fred Zinke. I'm Matthew Leach. Thanks very much for listening, everybody.